Welcome to Fresnolandia. I'm Jordan Maddox.
I'm Donnie Bergstrom.
We have a great conversation for you today. We're going to start by discussing the role of money in politics and how that illustrates who actually has power in Fresno County. After that, we'll discuss the upcoming Thanksgiving holiday and ways to avoid those often difficult and painful conversations.
All right. Today, we're going to dig further into the election results as we're getting more ballot dumps and more information about how money was used in this campaign. Donnie, there's a lot of perceptions about who has power in Fresno and who can influence elections. What are those perceptions right and wrong about?
Yeah. So I would say, and let me just preface this by saying, I've probably been diving into campaign finance and the weeds of who gives money in politics and how that works for the last four election cycles. So I have a decent sense of the last half of the decade, and then maybe a more macro sense before that.
And so you came in with some expectations for how this would roll out.
Okay. And I expected developers, and in particular suburban home developers, to be the main donors. And that's something that you hear repeated a lot. I know Councilmember Miguel Arias has said that on the podcast before, and I certainly have held that perception. And while a lot of them give money, they don't give money in the way that a lot of other people do, and they don't give the levels that unions certainly give. Fresno Teachers Association in this last cycle was by and large the largest donor. They gave close to $180,000 to two candidates in this cycle, one of which has lost and the other were still on the fence about whether they're going to win.
Before we move on, let's dig into why do you think people perceive developers as being the kind of the big players in the marketplace of money and politics?
Because they still get a lot of what they want at a policy level. And so while they're not, so let me break that down. They don't donate as a block in the way that unions do.
Okay.
Teachers don't give individually. They collectively donate through the Fresno Teachers Association. They have collective power because of that and lots of unions. Developers don't have blocks. There are certain things that they all agree on that they like at a policy level, at the local level.
So they're aligned, but they don't target specific things or specific people in that way.
I don't think so. And we were talking about this earlier today at Fresno Land, and a lot of them will give to both candidates. And it's once they know that they're going to generally get the right policy environment. So for them, it's lower impact fees, it's looser zoning, looser general plans that don't restrict their ability to keep building on the fringes of the city.
So in a Bredefield, Brandow campaign, they might perceive them both to be equally beneficial to what they need. And so it's more about building a relationship.
Yeah, exactly. And so they might donate. We saw a lot of developers donate to both candidates in that race, because at the end of the day, whoever's in office, you're still going to have to negotiate individual development agreements. It becomes a very specific to your specific situation. And so it's not to say they aren't powerful. They are, but they don't have power in the sense of voting in a block to tip the scales towards one candidate versus another.
I see.
Where that diverges is there's a different subset of developers, which is the developers and contractors that build things. So people who build schools or government buildings. There was so much money from those types of entities, all the way from architecture firms to electrical engineering subcontractors, that were giving tens of thousands of dollars, mostly to the school bonds, because school bonds mean they get more contracts. You saw less of those types of entities giving to specific candidates, again, because they want to enable the money to flow. And once the money flows, then they have to go through the bidding process. We also have laws in California that prevent a specific developer or contractor from giving money to a candidate and then that candidate voting on something for them. You see this with Richard Spencer. He's a very well-known developer in town. He owns Harris Construction. They have historically built a ton of Fresno Unified Schools and many other buildings. He gave to Steve Brandow, the supervisor candidate, but The supervisors just awarded a contract to Herrick's Construction, Richard Spencer's firm, about a month ago to build out two new libraries, one in Clovis, one in Reedley. And Steve Brandow had to recuse himself from that decision because he had accepted like $30,000 from Richard Spencer. So that's another reason why developers are also shifting the way that they give.
Okay. And what's new about this election in terms of how money was spent?
So SEIU, which is the Service Employees Union, they represent in-home health workers, mainly in Fresno County. There's over 20,000 of them here in Fresno County. So they gave huge amounts of money to Luis Chavez and to Gary Bredefeld. And I would say they're definitely a winner. Both of those candidates won those races. Now will that mean that both of those now supervisors will vote on a pay increase for in-home health workers, which is what they're wanting, and they've been saying that. I think it's likely that Chavez will. I'm not sure that Bredefeld will. They gave him a lot of money, and I'm not entirely sure if he has their vote yet. One new trend that we're also seeing in this election is, and this is something that happens in a lot of different places, is the emergence of dark money, if you will. And you know what dark money is.
I think I have a perception, but maybe just...
Yeah. So for folks who don't know what dark money is, money given to political campaigns, often candidates, but sometimes ballot measures that can't easily be traced. And because of the Citizens United decision from the U.S. Supreme Court several years ago, they've basically allowed this to happen. And so the way it shows up is you might see a company like an LLC giving a donation and you can't trace that donation back to a specific person. So I do tons of research on campaign finance. And so most of the time, it'll be like Richard Spencer, just we've already talked about him. He gives either under Richard Spencer or Harris Construction LLC. And you can easily go to Harris Construction LLC on the state's website and find, oh, it's Richard Spencer. He's the president. Now we've seen there's one LLC in particular. It's called Front Point Partners. They funded the signature gathering campaign for Measure T in Madera County. I think they put in, gosh, around $70,000 in order to help that measure qualify for the ballot. And if you trace them, you can only trace it back to this like very vague, I think they call themselves like an asset protection company based in Las Vegas. So it's like clearly someone who's trying to deliberately hide their identity. Yeah. And one reason for doing that, because most developers in town aren't afraid to tell you who they donated to. It's very obvious in the filings. No one's trying to hide that. But with this new law that I referenced earlier, it was supposed to end pay to play. And so now if you're a developer and you want to give money to a candidate or to a ballot measure and you don't want the possibility of losing a vote,
yeah,
of a conflict of interest, this is one way to get around that because there's basically no traceable way back to the original person who has the interest and the money's been changed. Now, I'm not saying this is what's happening in the case of Front Point Partners. We just don't have enough information. I did think it was interesting that the races that they donated in were Measure T, and then they also donated to a PAC that put out some mailers on behalf of Luis Chavez, and they also donated to Esmeralda Soria's assembly candidacy. So
it's an interesting confluence of
things. It is. I'm not entirely sure how those things are connected.
Huh. How ubiquitous is dark money in Fresno elections?
It's a really small minority. It happens every once in a while, and you'll see it. So that's like a business version of dark money. You'll see it on the nonprofit sides. And this is a really common thing where nonprofits will often form like a 501c4. So like you can't lobby or do political activity if you're a nonprofit, but if you form a 501c4 under the tax code, you can get engaged in political activity. So a lot of nonprofits will do that so that if they spend their day jobs advocating for tenants' rights, then they could, under the C4, advocate for a rent control policy in Fresno County or the state of California that's on the ballot. And so you'll see that. And sometimes there's an attack of that's dark money, because we don't know, they're not required to disclose their donor. So it could be like George Soros putting money.
It's definitely George Soros in Fresno, for sure.
I don't think that George Soros is active in Fresno. I have yet to see that. But that's certainly one of the accusations that's happened. There is a lot of money that's coming and they're not required to disclose. So it definitely is a version of dark money, but it's not super common. So when it pops up, I'm always like, what's going on here?
Yeah. So if you were to describe let me rephrase. If you were to describe to an outsider who the players are in campaign contributions in Fresno, how would you describe it broadly? Who has power in Fresno County?
I still think developers and business interests, and particularly real estate interests, more than any other type of business, really have the most power. Labor unions have really shot up. FTA, no one is disputing that FTA is a power player in school politics, and at the point at which Clovis Unified teachers unionize, that will also be the case in that district. But there are limits to money and endorsements and races. And that's the thing that we saw here is, you know, FTA, who was the biggest donor in the Fresno, in all local elections, again, put in almost $180,000 into just two races to oust two trustees who they felt like
Levine stayed in, and who was the other one?
So Andy Levine continues to represent Fresno High. He won that race. And then we're recording this on Friday afternoon. We haven't gotten the latest election results, and it's a toss-up between Claudia Casares, who's the incumbent, and Daniel Bordona, who's a teacher who FTA backed. So FTA might end up losing both of the races. And then that's a big question. Like, when you put in, they put in over $100,000 into the Levine Martinez race. And when you lose that.
Was that race, though, decided more because of the three-way split? Or
so, yeah, some people are saying that it's because there was a third candidate, Emma Villa, and she split the Martinez vote. Some people are saying that Andy had a much more solid ground game, and he was walking precincts, talking to people. He has some name ID'd because he's already the trustee. I don't know. I live in that district. I can tell you that a lot of people I know, Andy, he's a known person, but I saw, not that yard signs are any indication of any reality, but there's something. I saw a lot of Martinez signs. So it's not like he didn't have some support, like ground support. I don't know. All of this to say, I think that it just is a good pause. Hold up. How much does money really change the outcome?
Yeah. If you're Manuel Bonilla, for example, and you're looking at the outcome of this election and the money you spent, what's the lesson learned for him?
Oh, I don't pretend to tell them what to do.
No, but you know what I'm trying to get at with that question? Is the lesson learned here that money only goes so far in directing races locally?
I really think that, and not just for this race, but also if you look at the Fresno City Council District 6 race, it's an open seat. Gary Bredefeld's moving to the County Board of Supervisors. You have Nick Richardson, Marine Reserve officer, and you have Roger Benachtar. And Roger Benachtar out-fundraised Nick, I think, almost 10 to 1. So he had the money. He had every endorsement you could possibly manage it. He had the business groups, the chamber. He had all the labor unions, the more progressive labor unions and the police union. He had the firefighters. He had the developers. Like, no one was like, Nick is our guy. And Nick looks like he's going to win it.
I think this is a conversation that's happened nationally because we know that the Harris campaign vastly outspent the Trump campaign.
Right.
But Trump was also strategic in how he used media. And so maybe it's just a future where, you know, campaign finance reform like is still an important agenda item, but it's maybe like money in politics is losing some of its value. Is that maybe an overreaction to this election?
I don't know. I've always been, like, personally just a big advocate for campaign finance reform. If it was up to me, we would have public spending in elections and no private spending in elections. That's a utopia that I think very few places get to have. But I don't know. Maybe it's an interesting reaction to what's happening. It's a logical one. I don't know. Looking at, again, Roger Richardson, Benachtar, the other thing to think about is that we have such a fractured media environment. And so what Nick Richardson said was his positive is that he was just pounding the pavement every day.
Which is what Luis said to us last week.
Right.
Just knocked on every single door.
Yeah, just be high energy, have a lot of voter contact. Sure, maybe. I mean, I personally don't like talking to candidates at my front door.
Yeah, go away.
I am anti-stranger, although sadly I know most of the candidates in advance when they come to my door.
Another reason to shut the door.
Yeah, but I don't know. I still feel like it's a little too early to take it away, but I think there's a lot of fundamentals that are being scrambled, if you will, at the moment.
And what's the reverse? Like, what How is this going to change Fresno County in how money spent in elections?
I don't know. So I'll tell you this. So the Chamber of Commerce has historically been more, in the past, they have spent more in local elections, at least in the experience I've seen. And I think they spent very little in this cycle. And I would bet that it will make folks who have money to give or want to put money into elections a lot more targeted and strategic. Because if you're putting in $10,000 and it's not swinging the candidate, and then it creates a bad relationship with you in the, if your guy doesn't win, like that's just going to be hell to pay. So I think that could potentially change. And we've seen that with the chamber a bit. I don't know though. I'd be curious to hear from the labor folks, because I think they put so much money into the cycle, all the different labor unions. It'd be good to hear all of them at the same time thinking about this.
We're recording this a short time away from the most politically safe holiday of all, Thanksgiving, where we have to sit around a table like the United Nations Security Council and try to create a peaceful world. But it's hard. It is incredibly hard for many reasons. Most of us have family members who think differently than us. I have different opinions than siblings, parents, aunts, uncles, etc. Donnie, do you also have a kind of a heterogeneous household in terms of points of view?
Absolutely.
I'll start with you and then I'll share my thoughts. How do you approach table conversation? Is your tactic more avoidance? Is it curiosity? Is it gentle, respectful conversation? How do you approach it?
It depends on the person. There are certain people, my father included, who if you say one thing that is different than their worldview, it becomes a very angry conversation.
Okay, so it's a trigger.
Yes. And for those conversations, I just know we're better off talking about the weather, sports, fantasy football.
Okay.
Cool. I have many cousins and a few aunts and uncles for whom I love to dive in and understand the nuances of their perspective. I would say my opinion has changed on this over time. I think when I was younger, and I've been all over the ideological spectrum as an adult myself, but I think I felt more of a need to like help people understand my perspective.
You wanted to teach.
Yeah. And now I just bring my journalist brain, journalist like persona into it. And then I have so much fun. But there is something to be said for like,
how do you ask questions without coming across condescending? Because this is the ultimate challenge, right? And
yeah.
For overeducated people like ourselves, it's like, I do have genuine like bones of curiosity in me.
Yeah.
How do these things fit together, quote unquote? But I don't know how to ask that without, I already sound condescending, I'll admit that. I have that reflex in me and I think it's genetic. And
I have a picture of myself from eighth grade, and I'm like wearing a shirt that says Smarty Pants and I have my arms crossed.
That tracks.
And I just feel like I have been consistent.
Yes.
Let's put it that way.
Yeah. Yeah. But so how do you have conversations with questions without coming across that way?
I don't always get it right. I think I may have ended
on your best days.
On my best day. I was just going to say, I think I ended a conversation with my mother recently by saying, I'm going to go protect democracy now.
That went well, I'm sure.
It went super great. And then the next conversation after that was like, can we find a time to get together for Thanksgiving? So sometimes avoidance works. I think when I go into it, just not with a framework of I'm going to litigate.
Yeah, not an agenda.
I don't have an agenda. I'm not trying to convince them that my perspective is right. And that's how I generally interview people when I'm interviewing them for a story. I'm never trying to convince whoever I'm talking to that I'm right. It's more just like, what is the thing that I'm not seeing that's rational about your perspective? That makes it a lot easier. It is so much harder to do that, though, for whatever reason, when it's a person who I have a close relationship with, because then it's like,
because it's emotion. There's emotions involved.
It's emotion. And I think we still, it's a natural human thing to feel like if someone disagrees with you, that they're disagreeing with your identity, and to be able to decouple those things and say, like, this person can disagree with me even on things that are absolutely fundamental to my understanding of the world, but it doesn't mean that they are dehumanizing me. Now, I'm saying that as a white woman, I'm heterosexual. I don't have a vulnerable identity, so to speak. And so if someone says something to me, now I'm thinking about this because I know a lot of misogynistic men in my real life. Yeah.
I know one or two.
Like, I do have many men in my family who think that women still shouldn't work, that women, you know, should not be in positions of leadership, and we just don't go there.
Yeah. I would say to people, because I've had a lot of conversations, typically with my more progressive friends, you know, in the outcome of this general loss, you know, both houses and the executive branch, I think that if you're not actually curious, don't pretend to be. That's what I would recommend, because I think it's just too hard to assume this posture of neutrality if you're not actually neutral. It just comes across as pandering or something. And so my recommendation is to just avoid that.
Interesting.
Because I don't think, maybe this is just my point of view, I just don't think that coming across as neutral when you're not is helpful.
But it's not, at least for me, I don't feel like I come across as neutral. It's more just like,
or curious, maybe, is what I'm saying. If you're not actually, because you already have your priors about who these people are, what they think, blah,
yeah,
blah, blah.
It is, like, in talking about immigration, because that's a topic that I do have some feelings about, that one, I try to stay as curious as possible. And I think another thing for me is I also try to figure out, like, where people are getting their information. Because yes, that's a really interesting journey to be like, oh, this is your perspective?
Oh,
where,
yes.
What's feeding into that?
Yes.
Where are you getting
that
from?
And I think that's generally a great tactic across the board, not even just Thanksgiving. It's much more important how you know than what you know.
Yeah.
Generally. And how you know can determine a lot of things. But again, I think the challenge there is saying, oh, you get your information from there and avoiding that.
That is not a valid news source.
Oh, wow. You go to Breitbart. Wow. You get your, or you go to
OAN.
Or you go to some social media page that reposts like progressive Instagram memes. Like,
yeah,
that's where you get your information. I think it's true on both sides.
And then I become the preachy, like, media literacy person, and no one likes that person. But I've just accepted I'm going to be that obnoxious person in my family, and then it's fine.
Yeah. So let me share my point of view now. So my family and I have different points of view, not all of them, but some of them. And I am in a place now where I just really want to understand how they got to where they are. Let me give you an example of interesting conversation. So this is not my family, but my in-laws. So I have a family member on my in-law side of my wife's family that is very into health and wellness, really concerned about drug companies and those kinds of things. And it was just announced this week that Robert F. Kennedy Jr. might be appointed, if he gets through the Senate, to run HHS, Health and Human Services, FDA, a lot of these major organizations, CDC, that manage things like vaccines and drug approvals and all sorts of things. I could have a really flat perspective on someone like RFK, or I can try to look at the nuanced positions and like some and not like others. And so I think that's how I approach it. I try to really get to not the tribe, not the person, but what do you think about this person wanting to do X? Mm-hmm. What's your perspective on that? Do you think, and how do you understand this other thing that maybe I don't agree with, but I'm trying to understand how you got there? Mm-hmm. And so that's how I approach the conversations, is trying to make it as untribal as I can, but it's really hard.
It is so hard. I feel like it is really hard, but more power to you for trying. I think if all else fails, I will just go sit at the kids' table and enjoy that conversation.
I mean, that's why there's football on Thanksgiving, right?
True.
So you can just turn that on mindlessly gnaw on some yams and just return to what connects you all, kids and life and things like that.
Or another role that sometimes I will play, especially in my husband's family, is so a lot of conservative families in the Valley are not accepting of their LGBTQ family members, but we are like the straight people who will find our gay uncles and be like, if you guys need to vent, you got space.
You're a sanctuary person. Yes. That's wonderful.
So sometimes we do that and that's enjoyable. Mm.
We wish you all the best of luck in this Thanksgiving. Donnie and I's admonitions aside, it will be challenging for most of us. And so just recognizing that it's a single day and we will get through it. As annoying as that one uncle can be, we will all manage and get through to the next week. This has been Fresnolandia. I'm Jordan Maddox.
I'm Donnie Bergstrom. And this podcast was recorded at Sun Stereo Warehouse in downtown Fresno. Audio editing and mixing was done by Jordan Maddox. Our lead image comes from Vaughn Ballinan. And our song comes from Stateless Rat.